Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, October 7th, 2025, we're delighted to host a Courthouse Steps oral argument program on Childs versus Salazar, which is argued earlier today before the court. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's program, as the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, I will keep my introduction of our guests today brief, certainly more brief than their careers would deserve. So I highly recommend that if you're interested, you check out their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Professor Stephanie Barclay, who is Professor of Law and Faculty Co-Director for the Georgetown Center for the Constitution at Georgetown University Law Center. Before joining Georgetown Law, she was a Professor of Law at Notre Dame Law School, and her research focuses on the role of our different democratic institutions and how they play that role in protecting minority rights, particularly at the intersection of free speech and religious exercise. Before becoming a professor, Professor Barclay litigated First Amendment cases in D.C., where she represented many clients at both the trial and appellate level, including before the U.S. Supreme Court. Also joining us today as our moderator for today's conversation is Casey Maddox, who serves as Vice President for Legal Strategy at Stand Together. Prior to joining Stand Together, Mr. Maddox's legal career focused on defending the First Amendment rights of students, faculty, healthcare workers, and religious organizations. He's litigated in 35 states and also testified several times before congressional committees. And I will leave it there. A last note, throughout the program, if you have any questions, please do submit those via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so they'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. I'll ask that all questions submitted there, A, pertain to this discussion, and B, end with a question mark. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Mr. Maddox, the floor is yours.
Fantastic. Thank you, Kayla. I appreciate it. And thanks to the Federal Society and to the practice groups for allowing us to be able to have this conversation. So earlier today, this morning, the Supreme Court heard argument in Childs versus Salazar. This is a case that you will see described in the media as a case about conversion therapy. And it's basically the question is, this Colorado law, the minor conversion therapy law, which, among other things, prohibits counselors, licensed counselors in the state, from offering certain type of counseling to people who want to, in the gender identity context, become more comfortable with their body, and so reject sort of the feelings of the desire to change their body. And in the sexual orientation context, similarly, people who want to change either their identity or their behavior, their conduct related to sexual practices. And so that's the question that was before the court. You have essentially a law that, as we will discuss with Professor Barclay, raises some significant free speech questions, because while it also has other applications to things like shock therapy and other sorts of issues, those issues were not before the court. What the court was looking at today was simply the question of what's called talk therapy between a counselor and a willing participant. And so I want to kick it over to Professor Barclay. Thank you for joining us for your initial thoughts on the argument this morning. And then I'll jump in with some specific questions. And please do drop your questions. I'm sure several of you probably have questions you came loaded for bear on. So please start dropping those in, and we will we'll certainly turn to those. But Professor Barclay, your initial thoughts on the argument this morning.
It was certainly an interesting and exciting oral argument today. I think that a couple of the issues that I'm going to focus on are ways in which the justices were engaging with questions related to standing, to the question of whether or not this should receive Ms. Childs' type of therapy, that's talk therapy, should be entitled to full speech protection or should be given some lesser protection in the First Amendment, simply in virtue of the fact that it is a type of medical treatment. I think, assuming it is fully protected speech, then there are questions about how strict scrutiny should apply, how questions about studies or harm play into that, whether or not there should be more rigor that is applied in this context because we're dealing with viewpoint as opposed to just content-based discrimination. And then there are questions about remedy and whether this court, the Supreme Court, should go on to address strict scrutiny in the first instance or whether they should kick it back for further factual findings below in the first instance. So those are some of the things I'll touch on today. If it's okay with you, Casey, I think I'll start with standing unless there's anything else you want to jump in about any of that. So both Justice Barrett and Justice Gorsuch referred to Colorado's standing arguments as late breaking, buried in a footnote, but they were arguing in their briefing, really for the first time before the Supreme Court, that there shouldn't be standing in this case for a different reason, a unique reason from one that they had argued below. And that's just because they're saying we're now reading our statute differently. We're reading our statute to say that the type of thing that the plain text of the statute says is prohibited is really no longer prohibited. And Justice Gorsuch pointed out, you didn't argue this below. You didn't even give this the dignity of a Roman numeral in your briefing. It suggests you don't have a lot of confidence in this argument. And Colorado didn't disagree. They said, well, we did lose on this, on any standing arguments, not just this one, other standing arguments twice below. I think Justice Jackson and Justice Sotomayor came into argument loaded for bear, thinking that the standing argument might be a way in which Colorado might be able to win in this case. And I think that by the end, they were much more skeptical of the standing argument. In fact, one of the last things Justice Sotomayor said respecting standing is Justice Gorsuch said, but you acknowledge that if a client came to Ms. Childs and said, I would like to reduce behavior related to sexual attraction or others, or if I would like to change things with respect to my sexual identity, if that's their goal, that Ms. Childs would help them. And Colorado said, yes, with respect to their identity for sexual orientation. And Justice Sotomayor said, well, if you're not disavowing that, I guess that settles the standing question. So I think it's very unlikely that the court is going to rule on this basis. In fact, if anything, the fact that it was in their briefing to me signals waving a white flag that Colorado knew they're going to struggle on the merits when they were dealing with a Supreme Court that is accurately applying NIFLA and giving rigorous strict scrutiny. And so they were trying to find a way to duck and hide for cover. And I don't think that will be successful today.
The Sotomayor comment there. So I wasn't in the courtroom. I was listening online. So I don't know if you were in the courtroom or able to be there for it, but it came across to me almost like an aside. It almost sounded like she had turned to someone beside her to say, well, I guess that settles the standing question. At least that's, you know, sort of how the audio made it sound, as if it was a little quieter, not leaning into the microphone. So that it certainly did seem that way. It's also that, you know, certainly when Jim Campbell from ADF began his argument, there were a lot of questions about the standing issue right up front, as you noted. And by the time you got to Colorado, nothing in their opening had anything to do with standing. And it certainly seemed like they weren't trying to make that the kind of their lead argument anymore.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. There's a reason why I think they struggled to make that a lead argument. So if you look at the statutory language prohibits a counselor like Ms. Childs, a licensed counselor, to engage in talk therapy that would reduce or eliminate unwanted sexual attractions, change sexual behavior, or grow in the experience of harmony with their physical body. They define changing sexual orientation or conversion therapy as doing any of those things. And Ms. Childs' declaration says that if she were allowed to, she would engage in precisely those sorts of behaviors. And she would help a client accomplish goals of doing things like eliminating unwanted sexual attraction, which is precisely what this statute is prohibiting. So Justice Alito had a lengthy exchange with Colorado about this, where Justice Alito was like, this is what her declaration says she wants to do, and this is what your statute says she can't do. Colorado said, well, the statute is just illustrative there. We're putting a gloss on it. And Justice Gorsuch, and I think at least one other justice, referred to this as the peculiar reading, the peculiar late-breaking reading. And Justice Alito was like, well, regardless of how you're reading it now, conveniently, strategically, that's not how language works. That's not how statutory interpretation works. Something I would add to that didn't come up in oral argument, but the Supreme Court has held in numerous cases, including Stevens, that we do not have to rely on government's mere say-so. When government says, we're not going to enforce this law. Don't worry. Trust us, court. The court has, in cases like that, said you have to do more than that. And if Colorado had really wanted to do more than that in this case, if they were really serious about disavowing this type of what would likely be unconstitutional application of its law, they could have done what Virginia did and entered a consent decree with Ms. Childs and said, we're not going to prosecute this sort of shock therapy because that application of our statute would violate the First Amendment. They've never done that because Colorado is not serious about disavowing this sort of prosecution. We don't have to rely on their mere say-so now, and I don't think any of the justices are going to.
Oh, yeah. And if I can take moderator's privilege for a moment, I think it would be the court is unlikely to get there in this case to try to make a to decide that there is any real change in perspective on the law or clarification of the law of any kind. But even my own perspective is, look, if you're a state and you are passing laws that would on their face seem to infringe people's First Amendment rights, the best way to voluntarily cease violating people's First Amendment rights is to amend the statute. That's always available to you as a state, right? It's not right. As if there's been some enormous political change that's happened in Colorado that makes it impossible for them to push through a piece of legislation that would alter the statute to clarify what they mean. And, but regardless, it seems like that is not likely to be the result here.
Yeah, there were a number of options available to Colorado that could have passed a regulation saying this is not what our statute means, right. Even if they didn't want to repeal the statute. Right. Yeah, the fact that they haven't done those things, the silence is deafening on those actions.
Yeah, you get to a footnote in a brief at the Supreme Court where you right. You try to make that argument.
Yeah. And the justices rightly made fun of that, I think. So.
Right. So what it does raise, though, is you also have this additional issue that might be hiding in the background there, that this is Colorado after all. Colorado has had has made a lot of First Amendment law in recent years. They have been the genesis of, maybe it's a one positive example of federalism. Not only can states experiment with different things, but states can also be the experiments that lead to good First Amendment law being created. And Colorado has been a driver of that in recent years. Do you think that sort of is part of the issue that's hiding here? You've had several different cases that Colorado keeps bringing to the Supreme Court, looking to try to enforce them against people in sort of analogous circumstances.
Yeah, if you're a First Amendment professor, then Colorado is the gift that keeps on giving. Now, if you are a religious individual or a speaker in Colorado, then I think we're starting to think there's something rotten in the state of Colorado, because they have a really terrible track record now of any sort of protection or care for First Amendment rights in their state. So go back to Masterpiece in 2018, which they lost before the Supreme Court. Then they had the follow-on case, the Masterpiece 2.0, which was Scardina. They ultimately settled with the state on standing grounds, but the Colorado Civil Rights Commission was not being protective at all about Mr. Phillips' rights that had just been affirmed by the Supreme Court in that case. Then we had 303 Creative, which Colorado lost. There's another case that folks might be less familiar with, but it's a case called Bella that Beckett represented, where Colorado was going after clinics that wanted to provide abortion reversing procedures in a way that was discriminatory towards religious groups. And the lower court ruled against Colorado. They did not appeal that loss. There's, of course, Ms. Child's case, and I'm predicting at least a 6-3 loss for Colorado, maybe more like 7-2 or even 8-1 in this case. And then there's another case percolating right now called St. Mary's Catholic Parish versus Roy. This is a case where there's, I think, an incorrect Tenth Circuit decision that is allowing Colorado to subsidize other sorts of pre-K programs, but not St. Mary's, because of their religious policies. So in some ways, this is a follow-on case to Carson, a logical next step of ways in which the court might expand the religious funding line of cases and might even ultimately explicitly overrule Smith, because this is a case that would tee that up. We will likely see a cert petition before the end of this calendar year on that St. Mary's case. And if we do, and if the court takes that case, I predict that Colorado continues its losing streak under the First Amendment.
I agree with you. It's very easy for me as a First Amendment advocate to almost get excited about Colorado being back at the Supreme Court. But there are other people who are impacted by decisions being made in Colorado. Okay, so let's get into the sort of merits arguments that people are or that the court actually ended up grappling with here. What's the base case for Colorado on why this law survives scrutiny?
Yeah, so there's, first of all, the question of like, what type of scrutiny should it get? And Colorado has really leaned into putting its eggs in the basket of the fact that it shouldn't get any scrutiny here. It should get something closer to rational basis review. So Justice Jackson asked some questions that were relevant to this of Jim Campbell, the attorney for mistrials, and said, well, is this speech or is this treatment? And Campbell rightly pointed out that's the wrong question. The question is it speech or is it conduct? And it's definitely not conduct. All that's going on is talk therapy. The Supreme Court has already made abundantly clear in NIFLA, its previous case, that even speech in the medical context is not, even professional speech in the medical context is not given lesser protection unless it is incidental to and bound up with some other sort of medical procedure. That's not happening here. There is no other medical conduct. It's only the speech. And so when Justice Jackson was trying to ask, well, but is it speech or treatment? He was saying it doesn't matter. It can be speech and treatment. Treatment as a label does not remove First Amendment protection from this sort of activity. And I think there will be at least six votes to affirm that. The court reminded Colorado's counsel about NIFLA and Colorado's failure, I think, to really grapple with that precedent here. So then if it is fully protected First Amendment speech, Colorado has a really tough time because they have to prove under strict scrutiny that they are advancing a compelling interest through narrow tailoring. And the Supreme Court has previous case law that requires Colorado, including in a case called Brown, to show that there's causation with things like studies, that the harm they're trying to prohibit or protect against through their law is actually linked through evidentiary basis to some sort of harm. And I think that Jim Campbell, along with some of the other justices, cut like a knife through some of the reasoning of these studies and ways in which any of the studies Colorado has pointed to really, for the most part, referred to broader aversive practices, things like shock therapy or coercive therapy that everyone agrees in this case have no place in modern counseling. It is talk therapy alone by a licensed therapist to a consenting minor that is at issue here. And Colorado has no studies, none, that address that particular type of context and show any link to harm. In fact, the studies that Colorado introduced in evidence below at the trial court level concede that they can't prove causation of this particular type of speech and the harm that they're alleging. The studies and surveys they point to are all much broader than that. Justice Barrett honed in on this particular issue and she said, what is the best evidence that you have of this particular type of harm? And they said, well, we acknowledge some of this came in later in proceedings, but there are these two studies. And Jim Campbell, when he got up on rebuttal, the counsel for mistrials pointed out that their very best two studies they point to did not involve licensed therapists. They did not involve context where the therapy was just about voluntary talk therapy. They conflated and included aversive techniques. And so we're no longer separating out a variable to say that this type of speech is harmful. And those studies acknowledged that they weren't proving causation. So even the very best evidence that Colorado had a chance to try and highlight falls far short of the standard of proving causation under strict scrutiny. Let me go ahead and pause there, but there's some other interesting questions about how broadly the court might rule on that basis.
And Colorado's counsel seemed to indicate too that they were sort of looking for the court to remand the case so that they could put in additional evidence. You want to speak to that sort of like who has the burden here and what seems to be the likelihood of how the court is going to handle that question. It seemed to me that there was a lot of skepticism that that they had sort of missed their chance, that this was a surprising argument coming from Ms. Childs at this point about the lack of studies. And so they just couldn't have known that. They would have happily put in additional studies. That was sort of the tenor. What do you think is the likely result on that question, I guess, the possible remand for more evidence?
I think we're unlikely to see the court remand for more evidence, because basically what Colorado said was, yeah, it'd be nice if you could send us back because we now notice that we don't have a very strong record. But they also acknowledged, and counsel for Ms. Childs pointed this out, they acknowledged that when they were at trial, they knew that Ms. Childs was arguing that her speech should be protected under strict scrutiny. They knew what their burden was. They had an opportunity to introduce evidence. There was no reason not to introduce more or better evidence. And the legal burden is theirs. It's not Ms. Childs' burden to prove that her type of speech is helpful. It's not Ms. Childs' burden to prove that there is no harm. It's Colorado's burden, if it is regulating peer speech as it is here, to prove that doing so is necessary to prevent harm through things like studies that they had noticed, could have opportunity to put in the record, didn't. And just because they did a bad job before isn't a reason for them to say, pretty please send us back and let us have a do-over. The Supreme Court received similar arguments this past term in Mahmoud, where counsel asked the court to just rule on the question of whether or not religious exercise had been substantially burdened, and then to send it back, if assuming that the lower court got that wrong, send it back on strict scrutiny. And the Supreme Court declined that invitation because irreparable harm was ongoing on a daily basis with violations of First Amendment rights. The record was clear. The issue that the government wanted to pursue versus the type of religious exercise that the parents wanted to have was clearly teed up in a conflict. We didn't need more facts about that. And the same is true here. We have a declaration from Ms. Childs about the type of activity she would like to engage in, clear statutory language that prohibits it, clear penalties. Mr. Campbell even pointed out that there have been, during the pendency of this litigation just recently, complaints and requests for investigations filed against Ms. Childs. So that is ongoing now. There are further threats to her First Amendment rights. There's nothing that will be gained by sending this back for further evidentiary hearings because Colorado's own evidence concedes that it can't prove causation. And so this is an easy case for the court to address strict scrutiny and not remand.
Just apply strict scrutiny in the first instance.
Right.
So there were, you also had the question from Justice Jackson toward the very end, where earlier in the argument, the only of the justices who are Democratic appointed, I guess, who were not on the court for the NIFLA argument. And so she seemed to be sort of fighting NIFLA more than Justices Kagan or Sotomayor were. But she was asking toward the end, how do we distinguish NIFLA? I mean, she just straight up asked, how do we distinguish NIFLA here? And it appeared that the argument from Colorado, at least in that instance, was not advocating for a professional speech doctrine wholesale. It was basically saying, look, there is a much narrower exception in the medical context, and that's all we're asking for. Not a professional speech context, but this is treatment, and it's a treatment exception.
Right. Yeah. This exchange you're thinking about, she said, this is when she was saying, well, it's a medical treatment. Is it speech or medical treatment? And he said, that doesn't matter. It can be speech and a medical treatment. That label isn't determinative. And she said, well, the Tenth Circuit seemed to think that treatment is important. And Jim said, no, the only relevant question is this speech incidental to conduct? And so if the speech isn't bound up in something like, you know, consent to perform a surgery, or speech related to a prescription for a drug, then it's just full First Amendment protection. And she said, well, it's odd that individuals, like, that treatment wouldn't matter. But what Justice Jackson might be overlooking, since she wasn't on the court when the court decided NIFLA, is that in NIFLA, the court cites to Ninth Circuit opinions that try to carve out a separate category for treatment. In fact, some of them dealing with talk therapy. And NIFLA cites negatively to those Ninth Circuit opinions. So the court had the opportunity to say something about, you know, positive about the exception for treatment these lower courts were already trying to carve out. And the Supreme Court did the opposite. It cast shade on the idea that there would be any special treatment category. So I can't imagine we would possibly get more than one vote for that sort of outcome in this case. And I'm hopeful that Justice Jackson, when she looks closely at the court's opinion in NIFLA and sees that that would be really opening a Pandora's box, it would be hard to cabin that. I'm hopeful that that won't be a basis on which even she would dissent in this case.
So I think I've only got about two or three more questions. So please get yours in if you have them. I think the some of the hypotheticals that were offered. One, I believe it was Justice Gorsuch. Maybe I'm. It could have been Alito. I think it was Justice Gorsuch who had asked. Because the state seemed to be putting a lot of emphasis on the idea that, well, we have a there's a medical consensus here that this is the standard of care, right? And so we can require people to provide care consistent with the standard of care, and that's all we're doing. And so Justice Gorsuch pointed out that, you know, as recently as the late 1960s or very early 1970s, sort of medical understanding of questions around sexual orientation, gender identity was very much different. And so he asked the question, could in the 1970s, could states have decreed that counselors cannot offer people counseling to try to help them come to terms with their gender identity that was not the same as their body, or with a same-sex attraction. And as I understood the response to the question, Colorado's answer was essentially yes, that if we had been back in the late 1960s, early 1970s, those states would have been free to have mandated that there is one answer from the medical profession. It's this answer, and it is inconsistent with the standard of care to provide counseling that is contra that. Did I hear that wrong? And what is the implication, I think, of that response?
Yeah, you didn't hear that wrong. I thought that was pretty damning for Colorado. When Justice Gorsuch was asking, so if a therapist wanted to encourage affirming homosexuality, your position would allow Colorado to prohibit that. And Colorado said, that's right. And I think that was a pretty damning concession for them to make at that point, because that's the only way they can try and get around just how viewpoint discriminatory this law is in other contexts. But that's a concerning world in which we could prohibit counselors from engaging in that type of speech, or a counselor that wanted to affirm or encourage social gender transitioning. That's something that Jim Counsell said, by the way. He acknowledged strict scrutiny would protect that. If a counselor, say in a state like Texas, wanted to work with a client who wanted to socially transition and help them, strict scrutiny would apply there too. Different question if we're dealing with like medical surgical procedures, but if it's just social transition, those counselors should receive protection as well. The First Amendment should offer that protection across the board.
It did come up, the sort of interplay with Scrimeti came up as well. If you want to, I think you were just hitting on that point where they do seem to overlap. I think Justice Jackson also ended up asking at one point, treating Scrimeti as like the mirror image of this case and trying to say, aren't these basically the same thing?
Right. So Justice Jackson was saying, well, in Scrimeti, we were deferential. Why aren't we deferential here? And I thought the counsel for Ms. Childs did a good job pointing out that in Scrimeti, we're dealing with deference because there wasn't a constitutional right at issue. Whereas here, precedents like NIFLIP make clear that we're dealing with freedom of speech protections. And then the default isn't deference. The default is scrutiny. And so that's why we're shifting. It's not as though there's a double standard. But I do think it's interesting, if we want to talk about double standards, in Scrimeti, last term, Colorado told the Supreme Court that, quote, even when forms of treatment involved heightened medical risks, the longstanding approach of states in this area has been to enable minors and their parents to make informed medical decisions. And yet here in this case, Colorado is much less interested in allowing patients of people like Ms. Childs to make informed medical decisions about goals they would like to pursue that would be beneficial for those sorts of clients.
Yeah. You also had, this is kind of related to the point about the impact on the medical profession if you sort of have the state saying there's only one way to provide treatment and we're telling you what it is in this context. So Justice Alito asked, I think it was Justice Alito anyway, asked about Buck versus Bell, right? We had three generations of imbeciles are enough in Buck versus Bell. There was a medical consensus that the Supreme Court was sort of validating there. And I think the concern was, when you decree that sort of thing, I mean, this is maybe the confusing thing in Colorado's position on this to me was, if states had started taking the position that Colorado was saying they could have taken in the 60s, 70s, you would have almost sort of, it seems like you would have basically locked in a medical consensus. How does the medical consensus change if people can't, offer alternatives and you discover what they are, right? It's not even obvious that, you know, I mean, maybe it could only happen in the university context, and that's where you could have, if you have exemptions from those, but then why would a state need to exempt its universities? Mm-hmm. Seems like you'd have even more. If you have any basis at all in regulating licensed counselors, surely you would have a basis in saying to your state universities, for example, that you can't, perform this kind of research, which we've deemed to be, outside the bounds of medical science. So, anyway, that's, I'm probably more stating than asking a question, but it seems to me that is a, that would be a real challenge. Maybe I'll ask it this way. Am I missing something that you would have this problem? We've got the medical profession being told by states, or potentially by the federal government for that matter, this is how you have to provide services until the standard of care changes. But the standard of care now basically can't change because the medical profession is all sort of in lockstep with one opinion.
Yeah, you've pointed to one risk, which is that you might lock in a standard of care in a way that then the court freezes that in constitutional stone, and we can't really allow experts to continue to evolve. So that's one risk. But another risk was that Justice Alito honed in on is that sometimes, quote unquote, medical consensus can be politicized and there can be ideological positions that are taken. And he talked about medical positions and supposed consensus related to individuals with Down syndrome or other sorts of disabilities, and not just Buckley versus Bell, but you're right, he addressed that too. And his point was, with respect to that risk, that's the reason that we have these sorts of evidentiary requirements of strict scrutiny. We don't outsource them to the fact that some group of professionals is willing to, sign a brief about it or sign some statement. We just look at and evaluate the evidence. And so here in this case, if there was so much consensus, why isn't there evidence directly on point of harm of this particular type of speech? And I think Justice Alito is right to say that's why we have strict scrutiny, to check and make sure that this isn't just an ideological position that's being taken, and to your point, that then gets frozen in time, but that the science really backs up the necessity of the government acting in this way in order to avoid a particular type of harm.
I think that one of the questions that came up a couple of times in the argument was attempts to sort of compare this to things like someone providing counseling that was encouraging people, toward bulimia or something like that, right? It seems to me like that almost sort of highlights the problem that, like, this is an area that is part of a sort of a fraught culture war, and you don't have clear studies on point.
Right.
Whereas if you were talking about it might be at least, superficially, it looks like a challenging hypothetical. What do you do when you're encouraging someone to take an action that is that's clearly harmful to them, but all you're doing is words, right? I think maybe part of the answer, at least, is that most of those hypotheticals involve things that there really is a complete consensus on, that it is, it's not good to engage in that sort of behavior.
Let me give another reason why I don't think those hypotheticals were that hard. And this particular answer wasn't offered, but it's another one I think you could give, is that in contexts like a dietitian encouraging an anorexic client to not eat, or a doctor encouraging a patient with anxiety to commit suicide, both sides in that dispute probably agree that, like, dying or starving are harmful. Just like in this case, I think both sides would agree that risks of increasing suicide is a real harm. So, like, I don't hear Ms. Childs standing up saying, no, like, committing suicide would be fine. I hear Ms. Childs saying, no, I'm not encouraging people to commit suicide. Nothing I'm doing increases that risk. In fact, I'm helping them. I'm helping them to improve their mental health. And so in contexts like that, we don't really need a study, because it's like, we agree, people dying is harmful. And we also, like, they're conceding that they are advocating for a client to do the harmful thing. Here, that is in dispute. Ms. Childs is saying, yes, things like suicide risk are harmful, but no, I'm not encouraging it. And no, my speech doesn't increase risk of it. In fact, quite the opposite. I'm helping clients. I'm helping them to have happier, richer, more fulfilling lives. And it's only at that point where you have a factual dispute about, is this person advocating directly something harmful, that I think then we need things like studies to look at, okay, well, is, regardless of the doctor's intent or what their, you know, the link is between what they're saying, is there evidence that their speech actually leads to that type of harm? So I just think it's a different sort of context. Strict scrutiny would be much more easily satisfied in the context of anorexia or assisted suicide. And as Justice Gorsuch pointed out, we have a longer history of prohibiting people assisting with things like suicide. That could also probably be a reason why maybe that's a separate carve out under the First Amendment.
Is a very good point that very often with these cases, it's very easy to think in terms of if the court decides to apply strict scrutiny, that's sort of the end of the conversation. It's not, in fact, actually the end of the conversation. There is there are circumstances where the state would be able to actually win on a strict scrutiny argument, but it just has to actually have the evidence, the arguments on hand to be able to make that argument. So, right. All right, we're going to turn to some questions, but first, you've already sort of teed it up front, and I want to go ahead and give people what they came for. Your sense on the outcome of the case, what do you think the breakdown is going to be? And is the court just going to decide it, send it back?
I mean, I think it's possible we could have a unanimous decision for Ms. Childs in this case. I think Justice Sotomayor and Jackson came in more skeptical, but by the end, Colorado hadn't really answered their questions in satisfactory ways. And I thought they had a lot of their other questions really effectively answered by counsel for Ms. Childs. So I wouldn't rule out a unanimous decision in this case, like we saw in the Catholic Charities case last term, where it was a masterful decision that was written by Justice Sotomayor. And they were asking questions at the end. Justice Sotomayor was asking about some of the double standards here that Colorado had. Justice Kagan was asking if this is really viewpoint discrimination, maybe we can write this narrowly, basically, so that we don't also have to address what would happen if we're just dealing with content-based restrictions in the professional conduct. So you can see some of those questions from Justice Kagan seemed almost geared towards thinking about, like, What's a modest decision that we could write in this case? I think that is one way in which the vote could cash out. Is it possible that we might see something else like a 8-1 or 7-2? Sure. But I think there's no world in which Ms. Childs will get fewer than 6 votes in this case.
I think that is my take on the argument is that I think it's at least a 6-3 decision, could very well be a unanimous decision. If I had to guess, I would probably say that it's an 8-1 decision with Justice Jackson as the lone dissenter and with Kagan and Sotomayor, essentially, I'm not sure where there's a concurrence or dissent, but basically disagreeing with the majority deciding the strict scrutiny question here rather than sending it back. It won't surprise me if there's a little bit of a breakdown on that point. The only caveat I would give there is
I will say that Justice Kagan asking about viewpoint versus content-based and how we would decide that under strict scrutiny suggested she was ready to analyze it under strict scrutiny. So you could imagine a world in which Justice Kagan wants to join on because she wants to try and keep it a narrower decision.
As possible. I agree. I think the viewpoint discrimination piece is likely where this ends. I mean, they asked Jim Campbell and he happily conceded. All you've got to decide here is the viewpoint discrimination question.
Win.
That's the whole case.
Yeah.
The only caveat I would give is I was present for the NIFLA argument and I walked out of the NIFLA argument thinking, wow, Justice Kagan is clearly persuaded that there are some significant First Amendment problems with what California is doing here. I think Kagan is going to side with the plaintiffs. And after the decision came out, she actually ended up saying that was an example of weaponizing the First Amendment after the questions she asked seemed to be very concerned about what California was doing. Mm-hmm. So you don't know until this comes out, but I would be surprised if it's anything less than 6 votes for sure. All right. Yeah. So we're going to go through some of these questions. Paul Task asks, and he's picking up on one thing that I had written on Twitter. So I'll address the second point. Paul's noting I had raised on Twitter the fact that Colorado here, and this is a half-formed thought, so bear with me, but Colorado seems to be making the argument here that there's a distinction between identity and conduct and behavior. And so it would be one thing if a counselor is merely trying to help people not engage in sexual conduct or to get comfortable with their body, but it's a different thing if you're trying to actually advocate for them to change their identity and sort of separating out identity versus conduct, which I haven't seen this discussed elsewhere, but that seems to me to be contra about 20 years of arguments that conflated the two, that basically said anyone who tried to draw a distinction between those two things, that was a false distinction, that you couldn't, for example, have religious organizations with a statement of faith requirement that said, we take no issue with your orientation, it's about conduct and beliefs. And so it seems to me there's a bit of an odd situation here where Colorado seems to be trying to draw a distinction between the permissibility of trying to talk to people about not engaging in conduct, but not to try to get them to change their identity. I don't know if you have a thought on that, since that was my random observation, but that was my thought there. And then the rest of his question, he's asking basically about the voluntariness.
Do you mind if I ask the rest of the question? So there's two different issues there, and I'm going to break them apart. There's the issue of what was Justice Thomas getting at when he was asking about these other religious counselors that aren't being regulated. And then there's the issue of, is this conduct or not? How do we break those things apart? So Justice Thomas pointed out that under Colorado's law, if there is a life coach or other sorts of religious individuals that would engage in the same sort of speech, they're exempt under the law. So they could do all the same sorts of speech with regard to helping a client accomplish their goals of reducing unwanted sexual attraction or other sorts of behavior with no problem under the law. And Justice Thomas asked, what transformed the speech there into not speech here? And Colorado said, well, it's the special medical context. And Justice Thomas pointed out, yeah, but A, there, the speech might actually be more harmful because you have an untrained so-called life coach that's engaging this sort of speech in ways that might be less responsible. And B, we said in NIFLA that there's not something magical about the professional medical context that transforms speech. So I think that's at least part of the answer to Paul of what I think Justice Thomas was getting at here is this undermines Colorado's case under strict scrutiny because it's showing that the law is less restrictive not narrowly tailored in the way that it should be to really get at this sort of harm, assuming that harm was really motivating it. And then on the question of, well, what if the conduct is just trying to help this person change their identity? Is that what's going on instead of the speech? And I'm just going to go back again to the statutory text, because Colorado does a lot to try and run away from its own statute and muddy the water. The text defines conversion therapy to include any purported efforts to change an individual's sexual orientation or gender identity, which the statute then further defines to include any efforts to change behaviors or gender expression or eliminate or reduce sexual or romantic attractions or feelings. And so if that's done through pure speech, the statute doesn't say if you do it through conduct or some sort of procedure, it just says anything you do to try and reduce those sorts of unwanted sexual attractions or feelings or behaviors, that's prohibited. And that's precisely what Ms. Childs wants to do. She has a declaration saying, I used to do these things, I would do these things, but for the statute, there's no other procedure involved. And so that's why it's not conduct. It's just pure speech that the statute is regulating in a viewpoint discriminatory way.
How significant is the voluntariness here? And is there, how significant do you think that will be for the court's analysis? And how, it did not seem to me that the court was grappling much at all with the any potential argument for, well, is it truly voluntary if you have minors and their parents are the ones who sign off on the forms? When is it voluntary for the child? It seems like that could have at least been an interesting sort of question about what are the rights of minors and, you know, how can you tell that something is voluntary if the parents are the ones that are paying for it and signed a waiver form? But how significant do you think the voluntariness argument is going to be?
Yeah, so I think that the fact that Ms. Childs only wants to work with voluntary clients is really important in terms of, like, she's asking for an as-applied remedy for the statute, which means Colorado could still, under its conversion therapy law in the books, ban involuntary sorts of speech that were aversive or coercive practices. So she's not challenging that. Colorado could continue to ban that. I think another reason that the voluntariness is relevant is if that's really what Colorado was after, it could have written this law in a more narrowly tailored way, where it said something like, but counselors shouldn't provide this type of talk therapy if they have reason to believe that, in fact, the client is not operating in a voluntary way. So there were ways in which Colorado could tailor the law much more narrowly if that's really the concern that they were after. Colorado didn't. And that's further reason why I think this law is a prophylactic prior restraint on speech is going to struggle under strict scrutiny.
For guardian ad litem, if someone's parents.
Right. There's a lot of things Colorado could do to get out of that.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
and Ms. Childs, I don't think, would challenge those things. There's right. just other ways that they could have a more narrowly tailored law.
So there's also a question here, and this came up in the argument. The Colorado said there are 20 to 25 states that have these kinds of laws. How true, when we're trying to think about the scope of, like, how significant this decision will be, are 20, 25 laws actually sort of at risk? Is Colorado's law truly unique? What's the answer there?
Let me offer a couple answers to that question. So first of all, no, the 25 laws aren't identical to Colorado's. There are some laws that Colorado's throwing in the mix, like Utah's, that actually include carve-outs for voluntary talk therapy, like the one at issue here. So Colorado isn't quite accurately capturing some of those laws. Then you have states like Virginia that, again, have entered into a consent decree where they've said, at least applying our broad statute in this context, we agree that that would be unconstitutional. So we're not going to apply our law that way anymore. So it's fewer than half the states in the country. On top of that, remember that the remedy in this case would not be to facially strike this law from the books, nor would it be to strike any of those other laws completely from the books either. Those laws in any state where they exist would continue to be able to ban precisely the type of therapy that there actually is evidence about harm, things like shock therapy, coercive therapy with non-consenting minors. Those practices can continue to be banned. It's this minor application that is modest, just talk therapy by a licensed professional with a consenting minor, that would be protected. And yes, that activity will be protected in every state. And I think that's a good thing, but that still leaves a lot of law that is untouched by the court's decision in this case, if it rules for Ms. Childs.
Eric Treen asks, this is another hypothetical, how would a court address state restrictions on a doctor suggesting an over-the-counter supplement? So it's not an actual, I take it from this, it's not a, this isn't a prescription. This is just a doctor suggesting that this particular herb or something might be a cure. Is that speech, conduct? How would that hypothetical play out here?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, Eric. So I think what you're pointing to, and you're right about this, is that it would pretty clearly be speech incidental to conduct if what we're talking about is a prescription. So you have some speech about this prescription drug. And so what you're asking is, does that analysis change if we're talking about some other sort of supplement? I think it's still speech incidental to conduct because the thrust of the regulation is about the other thing, like how the herb might affect things, assuming that the government has regulated that at all, in which case the speech would be incidental to that. If the government hasn't actually regulated, like, the herb at all, and they're only regulating the speech about the herb, it would be wildly under-inclusive, under strict scrutiny, right? Possibly even intermediate scrutiny. So it's an interesting question, but I think that probably that's still speech incidental to the other conduct, which is the herbal supplement.
I'm going to ask another question that I had didn't come up today at all, at least directly, or at least to my ears, it didn't come up. Because it seems like this is the comparison that people tend to try to draw, which is to informed consent in the abortion context, right? And so very often you have, arguments that, the states have historically required that informed consent be include the following types of statements, like compelled speech, essentially, right? That the doctor must tell people about X, Y, or Z in that context. And I think even the example of some of the cases around the abortion pill reversal, for example, have been, at least in some states have tried to say, look, you have to tell people that there is the possibility of reversing the abortion pill. Is the answer there basically just that those are that's speech that is directly connected with an actual medical procedure, and that's what makes them distinct from talk therapy here? Are there other distinctions that you would draw as well?
I think so. I think you're pointing to the most important distinction, and one that would make those cases at least easier cases for the government. That doesn't mean government would automatically win. But in NIFLA, the court cited to three precedents to illustrate ways in which laws might have incidental speech where they're really regulating professional conduct. And so one of those, as you point, was Casey, where the court said that Casey was dealing with speech that was related to informed consent for abortion. And so if you're dealing with consent or information about or notices about a particular procedure that the client is planning to or wishes to engage in or is being offered, then I think that's an example of speech that's incidental to conduct. But no, it would be different if you're requiring a professional, you're compelling speech about some other procedure that the professional isn't recommending or doesn't want to recommend, or is unrelated to the speech that the professional wanted to engage in. That's closer to the facts of NIFLA itself, where the government was trying to require this facility that engaged in pro-life counseling and other sorts of services for women. They were trying to require that facility to provide notice and information about abortion procedures performed elsewhere, not by that facility. And the court said, no, that speech is not bound up with conduct now, because that's not conduct that facility is performing. So I think that would be an important distinction to make if you were looking at those sorts of cases.
I also have and this is going to be one more, and then I will we'll have us wrap up. You had one question that was basically the effect of, the implication of the question was that the Masterpiece and 303 creative decisions were very narrow, and asking, do we expect a similarly narrow result here? So you can address both the implication as to the prior decisions coming out of Colorado, and then the likely scope of the decision here, which I think we've already talked about a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, so I would push back on the idea that 303 Creative was super narrow. It was broader than Masterpiece, for example. And Masterpiece itself set some important law. It made clear that when government is acting with animus towards religion, we don't even go to strict scrutiny for that. The court affirmed that principle in Kennedy. Yes, just per se illegal. And the court also started building out this jurisprudence that it has since added to, that government can't exempt secular conduct and not protect religious conduct. And that was one of the bases on which Colorado lost in Masterpiece, and that continues to be an important principle today. And 303 Creative, of course, provided, I think, broad and important protections for expressive business owners in the public accommodation context that extend beyond 303 Creative. But bracketing all that, do I think that the decision in this case will be narrow? Yes and no. It will be narrow in the sense that it's probably going to be an as-applied remedy to this law that only protects this type of speech, voluntary talk therapy by a licensed therapist. But it's also broad in the sense that that's really, to my knowledge, like the main speech that any therapist anymore today wants to engage in. So in the amicus briefs that are filed before the court, including from therapists from Michigan, what they're saying is this is precisely the type of speech in which we want to engage that is consistent with our understandings of standard of care in the industry right now. And this is the speech that is being chilled by these laws. So the laws will still continue to operate to to prevent a lot of other sorts of problematic therapies, like we talked about shock therapy, coercive therapy, but nobody really wants to do those anymore. So like the type of speech that is at issue that would be most helpful towards clients that therapists continue today to want to provide will be protected with a victory for mistrials. And in that sense, I think it will be a significant ruling.
I think I agree. And I think the part of the reason I asked the question is I think there is this sense in which those decisions have been super narrow, but I think in practice, they basically resolved the major questions that are actually pending. You said in 303 Creative, for example, you don't in fact actually have a large community of people who want to deny services to people on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity, right? It's around the creative process and creating something. And so, you know, sort of it may look like a small decision to just decide on that question, but in fact, that actually sort of answers the whole question. I think the ACLU later issued a statement that basically said, well, this has turned out to be a very narrow result, but it was the only result that anyone was ever actually seeking. Right. And so I think that's, sorry, go ahead.
Let me offer one counter argument to my own argument, which is that the one downside of the type of ruling that we saw in contexts like Masterpiece, this won't be true of Ms. Childs, but it is true in Masterpiece, is that there in the religious exercise context, the ruling for religious exercise did depend on what professors like Chris Lund have referred to as constitutional luck, had the government happened to offer a secular exemption in a case like that. And it was because it was based on that sort of constitutional luck that the case could go right back down and then have Masterpiece 2.0, where he's being sued again in the Scardavia case about the transgender case. And so, or cake. And so, If the court wanted to provide a broader ruling, and I think one of these days, hopefully they will need to, in the religious exercise context, which is different from the speech context, they might need to do something like overrule Smith to provide broader protection that prevents the Jack Phillipses of the world from getting sued 5 minutes later if the government removes that secular exemption. So that's one area where I think someday we'll hopefully see a broader ruling, not relevant here because this is based on speech and not free exercise.
I agree. The only other the caveat I would offer to your caveat is that very, very often when you have these circumstances where you win because the state didn't also mandate things from other people as well, the reason they didn't is because it's really politically unpopular to try to do that. Right. It's one thing to say that, you know, this is this small religious group that we're going to deny First Amendment rights to. It's another thing when it's a significantly larger group of people. You know, if you have other businesses that are told, oh, also, by the way, the state has an interest in your creative process. Well, now you've got a lot more people to object to the First Amendment violation. And that's why the state doesn't end up kind of going down that path. So, with that, Kayla, I'll bring you back. And thank you again, Professor Barclay, for weighing in with us here today. And thank you, Kayla.
I'll echo those thanks to you both. Really appreciate you taking this section of your days and sharing your expertise and insight. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. Welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.